Good afternoon again. My name is Lou Ann Blake. I'm the coordinator of the Jacobus Ten Broeck Disability Law Symposium. Thank you. Once again, on behalf of the staff and members of the National Federation of the Blind, I'd like to welcome you to the NFB Jernigan Institute and the 2009 Jacobus Ten Broeck Disability Law Symposium. The theme of this year's symposium is New Perspectives on Disability Law, Advancing the Right to Live in the World. And I think you will agree that our keynote speaker presents a new perspective about attitudes towards people with autism, as well as policies towards those people. Ari Niemann is the founding president of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, a nonprofit organization of adults and youth on the autistic spectrum. He is currently a Sondheim Scholar of Public Affairs at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. In addition to serving as president of ASAN, Mr. Niemann serves on a number of disability and education policy committees. He is a board member of TAS and the Autism National Committee, is a member of the steering committee of the New Jersey Olmsted Implementation and Planning Advisory Council, and is the vice chair of the New Jersey Adults with Autism Task Force. He previously served as the policy workgroup leader for the Youth Advisory Council to the National Council on Disability. Mr. Niemann's advocacy work has been featured in New York Magazine and on National Public Radio, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and ABC News. At an early age, he has already done much to advance the right of the disabled to live in the world. Please join me in welcoming Ari Niemann.
Thank you very much, Lou Ann. And before I begin, I just want to say what an honor it is to speak at this event. Coming from a community that so often is denied the right to speak for ourselves and to take control of the public conversation about us, the chance to speak at an event named after the great Dr. Jacobus Ten Broeck and of the National Federation of the Blind, one of the leading powerhouses in the consumer-led disability rights movement, is something I truly appreciate. So thank you very much for the opportunity. The past half century has seen a great proliferation in new kinds of conversation about rights. Once primarily relevant in the context of criminal justice and property disputes, rights-based discourses have expanded their scope throughout our society. We have civil rights, human rights, women's rights, disability rights, immigrant rights, GLBT rights, commercial rights, social rights, privacy rights, animal rights, children's rights, student rights, parental rights, and so on and such forth. Though we may not all agree on the extent or even legitimacy of them, it cannot be disputed that we have broadened our global conception of the role for this concept called rights in our social, legal, economic, policy, and societal frameworks. And yet, at the same time as we have updated the role of rights-based conversations in our society, we remain with some very obsolete ideas about where rights come from. This holds us back. We go out to the world and we tell them in so many ways that it is time for our rights to be realized. We talk about inclusion, we talk about integration, we talk about access. But when we are asked why, our answers are typically phrased in the language of either cost-benefit or desperate need. And the one turns our civil rights struggle into a conversation on policy technicalities. The other evokes the very charity-oriented model of disability support that we have been trying to escape. Neither type of response brings the understanding and the knowledge necessary to communicate both the nature and the urgency of our priorities, because both talk about rights without talking about where they derive. To legitimize our rights, we have to explain where they are from and so show that they do exist in the ways that we talk about. But where do rights derive? That is the question. The Enlightenment political philosophy that our country was based on put forward the idea of a social contract arrived at by individuals in a state of anarchy, determining to place some of their God-given natural rights into a central government for the purpose of securing the remaining ones. This theory carries with it much charm. It fits our nation's philosophy of government by the people for the people. It recognizes and respects rights as inalienable, not temporal whims to be overridden by the first tyrant with a passing fancy. Unfortunately, it is also anachronistic and inaccurate. There's never been a state of nature, and our modern ideas of rights go far beyond the negative right protections against government intervention that all this model allows for. Our community would not be the only one left out by such a limited conception of rights, but we certainly would be one of the first and one of the worst served. What does that leave us? The United States Declaration of Independence says that men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. I believe that to be true for both men and women, it should be noted. Yet, for our purposes, this does not help us very much, because the very reason we seek a source for rights in the first place is to help us understand what they are. Barring a theocracy tied to a particular holy text, the belief that rights are divinely inspired does not shed much light on their nature. You, the people gathered here today, represent some of the leaders of a movement devoted to securing and advancing recognition of the rights of a segment of the global population that has been denied them, perhaps more extensively and more insidiously than any other. For generations upon generations, the very idea that our population was discriminated against, was deprived of rights, was not even on the agenda. Disability was, and in so many senses, still is perceived as a problem that should be solved by charity and whose persistence could be blamed only on the lack of sufficient humanitarian instincts on the part of the public and the as yet too slow progression of medical science. Disability rights were not on the agenda as far as the rights crusaders were concerned. That was a province for those who ministered to the poor unfortunates of the world, the sad accidents, the there but for the grace of God go I angels, who gave of themselves and found meaning in those tragic burdens. Then things started to change. Not so much with the world, though it is starting, slowly and not yet by any means surely to change, but with ourselves. We began not to conceive of our existences as mistakes, our misfortunes as God's will, and our utility limiting to being gracious for that which hath been given us. We got active. We got interested. We got angry. We looked out on the world and found the blame for our misfortune lied not with God or with medical defects, but with a society that was built up for centuries upon centuries, without any thought to the prospect that people like us might live in it. In that moment, and we have each found it at different points in our lives, but in that moment, we saw power abused, we saw injustice. In short, we saw wrongs, and so our rights were born. In that moment, that epiphany, the world changed for us, and disability rights were born. In my own community, that of autistic adults and youth, a group that has been targeted with an unprecedented wave of fear and pity mongering as of late, by entities that unjustly attempt to speak on our behalf, this paradigm shift is motivated by multiple sources. At one level, the socially constructed nature of at least some of our difficulties is a simple conclusion to reach, as many of our challenges are, by their very definition, social in nature. At another level, our community's outrage at lack of representation in the national conversation about us brought us to the disability rights outlook. This is represented for us in the neurodiversity movement, short for neurological diversity, which seeks to recognize our neurology, brain type, as legitimate and change the autism conversation from one of cures and eugenics to one of quality of life and equality of opportunities. Our movement for what we desire, independence, understanding, opportunity, respect, is a response to attempts to force on us what we oppose, dependency, isolation, pity, loss of control over our own lives. Interestingly enough, the very foundation of our legal system comes from something remarkably similar. Why do we guarantee in this country freedom of speech, freedom of petition, freedom of assembly, much less the right to a speedy and public trial or to not have troops quartered in one's home during peacetime. It is a direct outgrowth of our experiences with the British Crown. It was only once we had that experience with injustice that we could properly understand what justice looked like. A quick look across history will reveal much the same thing. Our national experience with slavery imprinted us with the right to freedom from forced servitude on the basis of race. The gains of the civil rights movement were not just the result of superior organization and a superb moral cause. They were our nation's recognition, still all too partial, of the legacy of lynching, segregation, and racism. Anti-Semitism was driven from the country club to the conspiracy theory fringe when the knowledge of the Holocaust came into our homes. Gay rights have advanced because of public awareness of brutal hate crimes, such as the torture and murder of Matthew Shepard. To quote Harvard's Alan Dershowitz, rights come from wrongs. Let us be clear, this does not mean that we are purchasing social goods with our victimhood. There are those that would put it in those terms, the people who claim that we are owed something not because it is objectively just for us to receive it, but because of our community having been deprived something else that would justly have been ours. Many aspects of the disability policy framework built in decades past are built on that idea, the retributive model of disability. This is the concept behind much of our Social Security disability infrastructure, for instance. The result of it has been a form of inaccessible infrastructure unto itself, with individuals forced to swear, even as many are only just starting their lives, that they are incapable of ever working in meaningful employment in order for them to gain the government support necessary to survive. The system was built on old assumptions of dependency. It was built for the conversation about need, not for the ones about rights and justice. It is one of many examples of the kind of infrastructure we must radically alter if we hope to bring the conversation about disability into the 21st century. Another example can be found in the reasons behind the recently signed ADA Amendments Act. For what reason did the disability community have to, 18 years after the ADA first came into effect, work to pass it once again for a considerable portion of the disability population? It is because the judges that interpreted the narrow definition of disability that the legislation sought to fix saw the ADA as a law about charity, specifically charity for the most severely impaired, not justice for all those who are being discriminated against. What does the idea of rights coming from wrongs imply then, if not compensation for having been victimized? It should serve to show us what direction our advocacy should take, and much more importantly, it should show the public the reason why the goals that our advocacy aspires to realize are important. For too long, our civil rights movement has been won largely by stealth. Even as we built tremendous political power and created civil rights laws and social welfare programs, we often did it not by making a credible claim that this is the way the world should be, but by playing on the idea that society should show compassion and pity for the disabled. This was not entirely our fault. We're dealing with a media, and as a result, a general public, that has not even begun to understand the nature and implications of disability rights. But regardless of why we are here, we still have to deal with the results of having won our legal and political victories while bypassing the social ones that most likely should have come first. The consequence is that our movement and all the progress it has brought is still seen in many, perhaps most circles, as one of charity or, worse still, as a stopgap until, be it by eugenics, euthanasia, or medical cures, disability is no longer a part of the human experience. This is what Dr. Tenbrook was referring to when he wrote about our right to live in the world and the failure of the broader community to accept that right as of yet. This knowledge places our struggle for recognition of even our victories on the civil rights front in context. Why, almost 20 years after the ADA, do we still see such extensive discrimination and lack of access in terms of employment and places of public accommodation? Why, 10 years after Olmsted, do we still see institutions and nursing homes that are near impossible for our people to escape? Why, after Deaf President Now and many such similar actions, are so many disability organizations, groups that speak about us, without us? why, after the MDA Labor Day telethon, which still persists, and ransom notes, and Autism Speaks is advertising, and countless other examples of unethical fundraising and advertising tactics, do we still see media campaigns that devalue our very personhood and cast us as less than human? The answer is because when we come to the public with our demands of rights and speak those rights unto the world with all the passion of the aforementioned epiphany that I spoke of earlier, the world only sees part of the message we are attempting to communicate. They see the demand for rights, but not the wrongs from which the rights were born. They look at the individual who uses a wheelchair, who cannot enter an inaccessible building, or the autistic student, like I myself in the past have been, who is excluded from his or her home school. And what they see is not an inaccessible infrastructure, but needy, pitiful dependence. And they may meet our immediate needs or our immediate demands for laws and public programs, as charity is still seen as necessary and good and proper by so many well-meaning souls. However, the enforcement of those laws and the implementation of those programs will never be as urgent or as meaningful a priority to them as it is for the true civil rights movements. To them, this is still very much a conversation about need, not injustice. This is not a petty distinction. To have a conversation about justice is to call for a civil rights movement that all members of the human community should feel a moral obligation to join in support. To have a conversation about mere need is to call only for charity conducted mostly by those who usually do not feel that need themselves and have their own ideas about the manner in which it should be fulfilled. I am reminded by way of example of an experience of my own group, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, had when leading a protest against offensive advertisements depicting children with disabilities as kidnap victims posted across New York City. The campaign, called Ransom Notes, consisted of faux ransom notes from the disabilities that had supposedly taken the normal children that were once hypothetically in the bodies of the now disabled young people. We mobilized thousands of autistic adults and those with other disabilities, brought support from 24 national and regional disability rights organizations, brought our community together as never before, and also garnered some support from sympathetic segments of the parent and professional community. Finally, after thousands of phone calls and emails and hundreds of blog posts and so on, our story began to hit the media with the UPI headline, "Ads anger parents of autistic children." Of course, the story was accurately reported in a few other news sources, and we did succeed in getting the ads withdrawn. But there is a certain sense of frustration over the lack of agency that has allowed our community. Even when every single one of the organizations doing press outreach and explaining our case to the public were consumer-controlled disability rights organizations, the only available paradigm that the media could place this in was one in which we were only passive onlookers as our parents fought on our behalf. Every disability group and most disability rights activists have similar stories. And so even as we spend more money and more political will as a society on disability issues than we ever have before, we're limited in what we can achieve because the conversation is not one about justice. It is not one about recognizing wrongs and rectifying the institutions that continue to commit them. It isn't about putting power in the hands of the people who have been deprived of it. It is about charity and dependency and all of those other things that infantilize us and marginalize us, controlled and perpetrated upon us by those who speak for us on our behalf and without our permission. The average member of the public does not know about Buck v. Bell or the tens of thousands of Americans with disabilities or perceived to have disabilities who were involuntarily sterilized as a result of the eugenics movement. They do not know about Willowbrook or the countless Americans with disabilities who have had to live out their whole lives in institutions, much less the many Americans with disabilities who still must suffer desegregation. They don't know about the Judge Rodenberg Center, still open, still present, still abusing, and school abuse throughout the country with aversives, restraint, and seclusion. The people in charge of our futures do not understand our history. They don't see ADAPT calling out, "We will ride or free our people." They don't see deaf president now at Gallaudet. All they see is the Jerry Lewis MDA telethon, or the Autism Speaks fear-mongering television advertisements, or Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey promoting pseudoscientific claims of pharmaceutical company government conspiracies to poison their children into autism with vaccines. It isn't just because the money and the media power is in the hands of those other groups. It's because the public narrative about disability doesn't know where to place groups like mine and the NFB and all those other groups in a movement like ours. The ideas about dependency run so deep, the charity and victim models are so ingrained, that the response of most reporters and members of the general public to our message is one of cognitive dissonance, before pigeonholing our movement into whatever disability narrative is easiest for them to classify us into. Maybe this is why the disability movement has not yet had our Rodney King or Matthew Shepard moment. Since the concept of disabled people as suffering is a natural, normal, expected thing in the eyes of the media and the public, suffering brought on from discrimination or abuse is simply placed into the same unfortunate but unavoidable category as all disability-related misfortunes tend to be. A perfect example of this can be found in the Supreme Court's Alabama v. Garrett decision, where the court struck down Congress's attempt to abrogate the sovereign immunity of the states from damages under ADA lawsuits on the grounds that there was insufficient evidence to, quote, identify a pattern of irrational state discrimination in employment against the disabled. To a slim majority of the justices of the Supreme Court, disability discrimination is not the result of having built infrastructures for only a portion of the population, but a perfectly rational act that the Equal Protection Clause cannot be expected to serve as a remedy for. To quote the court, "The 14th Amendment does not require states to make special accommodations for the disabled, so long as their actions towards such individuals are rational. They could quite hard-headedly, and perhaps hard-heartedly, hold to job qualification requirements which do not make allowance for the disabled. If special accommodations for the disabled are to be required, they have to come from positive law and not through the Equal Protection Clause," end quote. Here, once again, disability rights are not matters of equal protection given to full citizens under the law. They are portrayed as matters of charity that good-hearted people engage in and hard-hearted people may freely abstain from. The good news, however, is that this does show us what our next steps should be. It explains the biggest obstacle for the disability rights movement's ascension to the next level of rights discourse in America, placing us on par with other minority groups based on race, religion, sexual orientation, and similar attributes. This is the failure to take our message to the public. I'm pleased by the progress that we're seeing in that direction in respect to the growing disability history movement, attempting to incorporate the history of people with disabilities and our civil rights struggle into the classroom, just as the experiences of other American minority groups has been incorporated. In many ways, finding a way to cement our past into the American national narrative will be the best way to ensure we have a future. We must carry that message forward, but to succeed, we need our president and congressional representatives to join us in making that case to the American people. Beyond this, it is important for us to memorialize and to educate the public about achievements of men such as Dr. Jacobus Ten Broeck, as well as other disability leaders like Harriet McBride Johnson, or Ed Roberts, or Justin Dart, not just to pay respect to those who have gone before us, although this is important, but to show the world that we do have a history of taking control over our own lives, and that there is a real and legitimate civil rights movement of, by, and for people with disabilities. To quote Ed Roberts, "The greatest lesson of the civil rights movement is that the moment you let others speak for you, you lose. Showing the world those parts of our past where we have confronted the wrongs that are being committed against us and restored agency to our community is one way for us to take back our voice. Another thing that we must do is to begin to confront and to confront vigorously those organizations and groups that speak about us without us. When Jerry Lewis or Voice of the Retarded or Autism Speaks go to the public and claim to represent the needs and perspectives of the disability community with their calls for more pity, more segregation, more eugenics, and more distance from our dream of being recognized as equal citizens in this society, they perpetrate upon us an obscenity. This obscenity nevertheless has use in that it teaches us about how important to the disability rights movement it is for us to take control of our own message and our own community. We must organize not just around laws, but around the public conversation on disability, confronting those corporate donors and political infrastructures that give support to these repressive, fear-mongering groups that challenge our right to live in this world. To quote Dr. Tenbrook himself, "There are large and powerful agencies abroad in the land, considerable in number and vast in influence, which remain hostile to our movement in thought, in speech, and in action. Under the guise of professionalism, they would perpetrate colonialism. Their philosophy is a throwback to the age of the silent client before the revolution in welfare and civil rights, which converted the client into an active and vocal partner in the programming and dispensing of services. In their lofty disregard of the organized blind as the voice of those to be served, they betray bureaucratic bias that is an image of the blind client not as a person to be served, but as a defective mechanism to be serviced. The same could be said of many organizations that speak about us without us in many disability communities. Finally, in order to communicate our message to the public, we must also realize that the most effective social change comes not from activism, but from individuals and individual discussion. For the public to understand that the disability message is a civil rights message, they must hear that message from their friends, their family members, and their co-workers with disabilities. Beyond this, for us to accomplish that, we must succeed in broadening the base of the disability rights movement to encompass a broader scope of people with disabilities. There remain too many people with disabilities who do not yet have the chance to participate in our community, and whose identity is only explained to them in medical terms. We must broaden our community and give every disabled person access to the disability culture and perspective. I'd like to end by quoting American philosopher Henry David Thoreau, who said, "You have built castles in the clouds. Now you must build the foundation underneath them." As we talk about how to imprint the American public with the meaning and message of the disability rights movement, we talk about what must be done to build the foundations that will show that our vision is no dream. This is what we must do. This is what we can do. This is what we will do. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to working with all of you to bring that dream into reality.